Tim Marchman is part of a reporting team at Vice News that's been covering the story of Tim Ballard. He's the founder of the anti-trafficking group Operation Underground Railroad, O-U-R. And Marchman told us this week about the story that inspired Ballard to begin O-U-R, the kidnapping of a three-year-old Haitian boy named Gardy Marty from an LDS meeting house in Port-au-Prince in 2009. The boy's father is a U.S. citizen, so the FBI got involved in the search and the investigation, but the little boy was never found. He's still missing. But Marchman says the story became the guiding purpose for OUR. Tim Ballard, he says, raised money to keep searching for Gardy. In OUR promotional materials, Ballard talked about their efforts, tracing leads and consulting intelligence sources. He said they would never give up on the search. Here's Tim Marchman.
So in February 2016, Tim Ballard, a group of associates of his who, among other people, comprised former members of U.S. Special Forces, and Gesno Marty, the boy's father, went to a village on the border of Haiti and the Dominican Republic on the basis of what Ballard portrayed as intelligence he'd received that had given them a solid lead on where the boy was located. This was basically a sort of private paramilitary mission. The people were dressed up as doctors, seeking to infiltrate this village under the guise of providing humanitarian medical care, which, if done by someone acting under color of government authority, is actually a war crime in some contexts. And among the operatives, there was also a camera crew. This was all being filmed for a proposed television series in which OUR and Ballard's operations would be presented as they sought to act as modern-day abolitionists and bring an end to the scourge of child slavery. But the most unusual thing about this mission may have been that one of the operatives who was there, and in fact, unbeknownst to many of the people there, was the source of the intelligence, who was actually a woman from Utah named Janet Russin. And according to investigative documents generated by an FBI investigation, her intelligence was sourced to dead Mormon leaders, including the prophet Nephi, who, according to the Book of Mormon, died about 2,600 years ago. And according to video that was acquired by the investigators, she told Gesno, the father, that his child was here. She said, "No way you would have found this place. No way." And Ballard told Gesno, "Gesno, buddy, he's here. We're going to get him." So as best we know, the sole form of intelligence that they were using on this mission and throughout their many missions and operations in search of Gardy was intelligence from the psychic medium, Janet Russin, who was right there telling a man whose son had been missing for close to 7 years that they were about to find him. What ends up happening is that some elders in the village who were very perturbed by these random people showing up with a camera crew and poking around the village asked them to leave. And Ballard has told this story in the past in ways that would make it seem as if he was chased out by shotgun-wielding predators. But the reality appears to be more that people didn't like strangers just randomly popping up with no clear motive for being there and encourage them to leave. OUR made its reputation on bringing together the best of the best to fight child slavery. And Ballard has represented himself as a former CIA agent who worked undercover with HSI in foreign locales to address the scourge of trafficking. And instead, the intelligence is gathered through a psychic medium. And I think that no matter what the source of the intelligence is, to assure a father that you're about to locate his missing son is a really questionable thing to do. And to do so on the basis of psychic communication with the afterworld is just unimaginable. So there's the inherent cruelty in putting someone in that situation, I think. But the other thing you have to think about is that OUR is a group that over the past decade has raised about $250 million. And so to learn that all that money is going not to fund dangerous undercover work collecting information or exotic technical means of information collection, but is instead going to pay a psychic medium, I have to think would raise questions for anyone who's ever donated money to the organization, which is a lot of people.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Tim Ballard, based on the reporting of Tim Marchman and his reporting colleague Anna Merlin at Vice News. We're talking about Ballard's remarkable reversal of fortune. Their work, including the use of documents from a now-closed criminal investigation, catalogs Ballard's rise, his ambition, and the questions raised over claims he's made about rescuing trafficked children. Over the course of the past few months, Ballard has left Operation Underground Railroad. He was publicly rebuked by his church. He's been accused of sexual misconduct and spiritual manipulation by women who worked for him. Tim Marchman and Anna Merlin joined us earlier this week.
Tim Ballard is a guy from Southern California. He was originally born in Utah, but he was raised in Southern California in, by all accounts, devout LDS family. After his education, he decided to join the government. And he's told a story about how he worked for the CIA. He's implied that he was an agent or an operative. The best information we have is that he was very briefly, essentially, an intern. And then he joined Homeland Security Investigations, which is a division of ICE. So again, in his telling, he was a sort of key figure in HSI's attempts to stop trafficking at the border and operating overseas in an undercover capacity. We do not believe that's true. The indications we have from a variety of things, from talking to former colleagues of his, as well as examining the kind of paper trail, is that he was largely a desk-bound analyst for about 10 years. And that's not to diminish that work or say that, you know, it wasn't real or he didn't really work for the government. But despite his later attempts to portray himself as something of a Jason Bourne figure, that just doesn't appear to be what he was doing. After about 10 years in government, he leaves government and basically starts up a private anti-trafficking group called Operation Underground Railroad. Yeah. After he had participated in an operation that was a collaboration between Colombian law enforcement, the U.S. government, to take down a trafficking ring. So in his version of the story, which is elaborately mythologized in Sound of Freedom, the summer's box office hit, he was working hard inside the bureaucracy and saw that his colleagues and the government generally just didn't care about child sex trafficking, and he saw that he would have to leave government to do anything effective. The kind of alternate narrative there is that he was a real self-promoter, like a bit of a dreamer, engaged in a few sidelines, like working on, frankly, pretty absurd works of pseudo-history that suggest, for instance, that George Washington was visited by the angel Moroni during the Revolutionary War. He sees an opening for himself to work in the anti-trafficking cause with private funding to have a little more freedom of action and bring attention to this cause through the promotion of elaborately filmed videos featuring undercover paramilitary officers freeing women and children abroad from sex slavery. Yeah. So without getting into any speculation about the validity of his motives, it is fair to note that right from the beginning, OUR was very much focused on basically producing media content.
and doing so in a way that is counter to generally accepted best practices mm-hmm. for working with survivors of trafficking, for working on operations meant to stop individual traffickers, and generally operating in a very sensationalistic way, and what many people have said is an exploitive way.
You mentioned it's you can't pinpoint or fact check his motives, but you do write about his vision, and I want to ask you about this in your reporting, because you lay out in your article, your articles, I should say, this thing that happened in August of 2019, this diagram where they lay out Tim Ballard's vision. There are various elements of that I kind of wanted to talk about, but it seems to give us a sense of his like 5-year plan or something, like his aspirations. I'll mention one public speaker. One part of this is to build an empire as a public speaker and as an anti-trafficking advocate. Talk a little bit about that. This he has a very grand idea of what he wants to do here. And do we know if that vision included, you know, larger aspirations like elected office, those kinds of things? Talk a little bit about that part.
Right. So this whiteboard, which we and other media outlets have reported on, essentially was said to have been drawn by Mr. Ballard at a meeting wherein he was sort of laying out his vision to connect the nonprofits that he was part of, including OUR, with sort of for-profit businesses, you know, all leading back to this idea of making him into a sort of central figure in both this sort of anti-trafficking world and sort of, I think one person said that his goal was to be, you know, like a major media figure. It looks to most reasonable observers like a plan to sort of try to monetize OUR and the fame that he garnered as a result of starting the organization. And specifically, there was this phrase that many people were struck by who, you know, had either been in the meeting or knew about it, which was on the whiteboard, it said, the sizzle of the rescue will lead them to the covenant. The idea being that the rescues that OUR undertook would serve as essentially, you know, positive PR for the LDS faith and would lead people to the church. So the idea being that OUR was on some level sort of marketing for Mormonism as Mr. Ballard understood it and for Mr. Ballard sort of personally.
There's something revealed in notes between criminal investigators and a former, I guess, high-ranking person in Operation Underground Railroad that Ballard was, and I'll quote from your story, fully convinced that he's supposed to be the Mormon Messiah and lead people back to the church. Like that was part of the vision, I guess.
Yeah, it's quite an expansive and grandiose and frankly pretty bizarre vision. But aside from OUR, he was involved with a number of other nonprofits, for instance, the Nazarene mm-hmm. Fund, which is a group that Glenn Beck funded to basically support the exfiltration of religious minorities, mainly Christians, from ISIS-controlled territory in the Middle East, largely Syria, some parts of Iraq. So he's got another sister organization to OUR called Children Need Families that is not organized as a nonprofit, but is an adoption group that helps people, apparently largely in Utah, adopt children largely from abroad, like in Haiti. So he's got this kind of network of nonprofits and nonprofit-like groups. He's got other interests, like a CrossFit gym that's operating literally under the Underground Railroad banner. It was under their offices in Utah. And he wants to draw all these together under the umbrella of a group called Slave Stealers, which would be a for-profit company that would control the nonprofits and ultimately funnel reflection money and attention to him personally, with this grander idea of him being a sort of messianic figure who would restore America's relationship with the covenant. And although it's not reflected in the whiteboard diagram, we had long heard, well before he started talking recently about his intention to run for a Senate seat next year, that elected office would be part of it.
How much of this, as far as you could both tell, was a Latter-day Saint operation, and how much of this was a more sort of conservative Christian kind of movement? I think some people would say, what's the difference? But I think those in Utah would say there is a difference. And I sometimes get confused about how much of this is just right-wing Christian stuff and how much of this is right-wing Latter-day Saint belief. What do you think? Is there a distinction? How do you understand that part of the story?
It's a really interesting question. And I think there are a few specific things you can look at. One is that Utah specifically has definitely been a place where anti-trafficking fundraising and anti-trafficking groups have really thrived and prospered. And some of those have not been up to the best aims. There's a case of a woman who was recently indicted on about 30 counts of various charges, including fraud. She had run a small anti-trafficking group that claimed to be working all over the world to, among other things, exfiltrate refugees from Afghanistan, which she didn't appear to have any particular qualifications for. But she nevertheless claimed that she was talking to heads of state and various important people and doing the necessary work to do all this that no one else could do. There have been multiple cases of people telling extraordinarily unlikely stories about their own harrowing experiences of being a victim of sex trafficking who have thrived and flourished. And I think there are probably a couple of reasons for that. One is that Utah statistically has an abnormally high level of sex abuse. So I think it's a problem that is very real to people there that they want to do something about, that they're sensitive to. I think that in LDS communities specifically, there's been a lot of talk about vulnerability to affinity fraud, something that comes out of very good motives. The idea that if people in your neighborhood or people in your community want you to get engaged in a cause, for a lot of people, their instinct is to say yes, and it becomes easy for people to prey on that. And I think the power of these groups and this appeal to the community is largely rooted in very good stuff, just people's desire to do right. So the extent to which they're pitching specifically Mormon audiences as opposed to evangelical audiences is a really knotty one, just because of the, knotty relationship between those two communities. There are a lot of evangelical communities in America who are going to protest that, that Mormons are Christian at all. And so I think it's a very interesting thing that Ballard and OUR have over the years been able to address both those audiences simultaneously in ways that don't alienate one or the other. And I don't even think it's so much a matter of code switching. I think it's a matter of, at root, the power of their central appeal, which is that child sex trafficking is a scourge. It's one of the things that we can all agree is horrible. There's no constituency for it. There's no one who's in favor of it. There are only differences of opinion about what the most effective way to address it is. And by presenting this very powerful, if provably false narrative that no one in government cares, elites don't care, no one is doing anything about this, but we can do something about this, we can act out of faith, that's such a kind of broad and vague message that I think it can resonate with different communities that may have a lot of distinctions between them, just because it's not getting into specifics at all. It's not getting into questions of theology. It's not getting into questions of what community you're part of or anything like that. It's saying, we are all Christians. We are all people of faith. If we work together, if we pool our resources, we can stop something that is horrible and that nobody else is doing anything about.
What can you say about that central question there, whether or not, in fact, child sex trafficking, for example, is the scourge that they claim it is? I mean, a few years ago, we had this conversation with Caitlin Tiffany with the Atlantic. She had written this piece. She described it kind of as this moral panic. And one of the things she did, and I think maybe we should say here, is as a kind of disclaimer, yes, human trafficking and child sex trafficking happens. It's a crime that human rights organizations and governments worry about and they do track. But it's just not happening at the scale or in the way that people like those with Operation, you know, Underground Railroad say it is. What do you want to say about that part of this story? Because a lot of Ballard's message is based on the fact that this is happening everywhere. It's insidious and it's so prevalent. What do you want to say about that part?
Right. So obviously sex trafficking is real. It happens. It is much more common than OUR has typically indicated for sex trafficking to happen at the hands of, for instance, people's relatives, their romantic partners, someone with whom they already have a relationship. Trafficking rarely takes the form that OUR sort of spoke the most about over the years, which is the idea that somebody, a child or a young woman, will be abducted by strangers and, you know, sold into sexual slavery. That is relatively less common than other forms of trafficking. And again, this is according to, you know, dozens and dozens of experts that we've spoken to over the years who look at this problem academically, who work in law enforcement, who work in government. This is just what we hear repeated over and over and over. The other thing, obviously, is that OUR and sort of similar groups tend to focus pretty much solely on sex trafficking as opposed to, for instance, labor trafficking, mm-hmm. which is also a huge problem in this country. Sometimes those two things overlap and someone is victimized by both of them. And there tends to be, for whatever reason, especially in their marketing materials, a focus especially on young female victims when we know, for instance, that teenage boys doing survival sex work are at pretty high risk of being trafficked, you know, by someone who, for instance, is somehow in control of them, either takes control of their documents, you know, has an emotional hold over them. So there have been a bunch of ways in which experts we've spoken to have said that while OUR's sort of specific talking points about trafficking, it's not that they never happen. It's not that this specific form of trafficking is completely unreal and unheard of. It's that they tend to prioritize a certain type of trafficking that is perhaps in some ways more sort of dramatic and lurid over other types. You know, one specific way that we have seen this play out with OUR specifically is just in sort of Mr. Ballard's sort of specific desire often to emphasize, and I'm sorry to be a little bit explicit here, to emphasize the number of times that he says a specific trafficking victim has been raped or sexually assaulted. You know, there tends to be a lot of discussion about, you know, someone being raped or sexually assaulted 30 or 40 times a day, you know, really playing on those specific images, repeating them for our listeners and viewers. And in some cases, you know, as in with the case of a woman we wrote about who OUR and Mr. Ballard have called Liliana, those numbers were not accurate. And Liliana's story was bad enough as it was. You know, the number of times and the like type of sexual abuse that she had faced was already bad enough. So in general, we tend to see sort of a heightened rhetoric, a bit of exaggeration, and an overall sort of desire to focus on the most kind of lurid and extreme stories.
That's Anna Merlin and Tim Marchman. We have a link to the reporting for Vice News on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. What do you understand about Tim Ballard's relationship with leaders with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, high-ranking leaders? And this brings us to M. Russell Ballard, who is the president, acting president of the Quorum of the Twelve. What can you say about what Tim Ballard described as his relationship with President it's weird here because they're not, I don't think they're related, but they're Ballard, obviously.
They're not related.
Yeah. So I'll just describe M. Russell Ballard as President Ballard. What do you understand about that relationship, the way Tim Ballard talked about it and the reality of the relationship?
So a couple things. There is absolutely no doubt that Mr. Ballard had a relationship with the sort of power structure of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. For one thing, you know, his books were published by Deseret Books. You know, Deseret is a publishing imprint and a news outlet that is you know, partially owned by the church, or I think majority owned by the church, right? And also, you know, over the years, Mr. Ballard has done things like appear at fireside chats and, you know, sort of other places within kind of Mormon officialdom that are considered to be, you know, honors. At the same time, we know that he did have a friendship of some kind with President M. Russell Ballard, no relation. President Ballard said in a speech, I think in 2019, you know, he described Tim Ballard as a friend of his and said that they had sort of bonded over their love of American history, right? What happened, however, is that the LDS Church issued a statement to us in the middle of September, essentially denouncing Tim Ballard in a way that is very unusual and saying that Mr. Ballard took this relationship with President Ballard and, in their words, betrayed it and used President Ballard's name in unauthorized ways, as they said, for, quote, Tim Ballard's personal advantage and activity regarded as morally unacceptable. So essentially, the church is trying to create a little bit of a dividing line between themselves and Tim Ballard's activities. They're saying, you know, that this was a personal friendship and not a business relationship.
So what we know from the investigative files that we've been reporting on is that there was an extraordinarily close relationship between the two men. For instance, one of the missions that OUR went on, a paramilitary mission in Haiti, to find a boy named Guardy Marty, who had been kidnapped many years ago, and whose you know, the quest for finding him, Tim Ballard presented many times as one of the founding stories of OUR, the desire to find this boy. Tim Ballard was talking to President Ballard from the scene of the operation.
Wait. So he's on a cell phone with the acting president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles during...
giving him updates on the search for this boy as they're out in the field. He represented that he had obtained a very powerful blessing from President Ballard before the mission. He, in private meetings, would talk about President Ballard's authorization of various activities, of his knowledge of the use of psychic intelligence on missions. He, in the whiteboard meeting we discussed, represented President Ballard as a silent partner in his for-profit business, an associate of his in the course of trying to strong-arm a third party into surrendering a business of his own to acquire an equity stake in this for-profit business, Slave Stealers, represented that a fourth party could meet, if necessary, with President Ballard to kind of cement the deal. And we know that in...
Did that ever happen?
We don't know. We also know that another business, which we don't know much about, called Liberty 89, Tim Ballard appears to have represented that Elder Ballard was a silent partner in that. So what the church was specifically referring to was that in the investigative files, there was substantial reason to think that the two were business partners in this kind of convoluted scheme to monetize Tim Ballard's notoriety. And there was no question whatsoever that Tim Ballard had been heavily representing that to be the case during business negotiations, among other things. So really what the church's statement was doing was, you know, not just drawing a line between them, but specifically sort of refuting the interpretation that you could draw from these materials we've been reporting on, that President Ballard was the power behind the throne at OUR, that OUR was a project of his, that it was an extension of his authority or the authority of the church. The church is saying, no, that's not the case. What was happening here was that Tim Ballard was just talking and talking and talking and talking and trading on this powerful figure's name, but he had no part in any of this. And, you know, I think it's very difficult to say what the real truth is there. I tend to think that probably the relationship with them was nothing like what Tim Ballard represented in private to some people. And at the same time, we do believe that it was closer than the church would now like people to think of it as.
So one of the stranger elements of the story is the involvement of a woman named Janet Russin.
I believe so.
Yeah. She's described as a psychic medium. Talk about her. How did you find out about her? You were reporting that one of the prosecutors in Davis County was investigating the Operation Underground Railroad, and these documents found somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 pages of psychic readings in the story. Talk about Janet Russin.
Right. So we first reported on Ms. Russin's relationship and affiliation with OUR in 2021. When we were talking about this particularly disastrous mission on the border of Haiti and the Dominican Republic to find Gardi Marti. And so people familiar with that mission told us back in 2021 that folks on the mission had learned sort of, you know, mid-mission that the intelligence that had put them where they were was Ms. Russin's psychic visions. And they learned this because Ms. Russin showed up with Tim Ballard. And they kind of said, well, who is this? So we were then able to report earlier this month a little bit more sort of substance about Ms. Russin's kind of relationship with OUR. So specifically during that mission to find Gardi, Ms. Russin credits herself with locating him, though in fact he was not found that day and has never been located since, and actually told Gardi's father, Gesno Marti, you know, that his child was nearby, that they were about to find him, you know, and says, you know, no way you would have found this place without me, essentially is what she's saying. You know, we later learned that Mr. Ballard relied a great deal on Janet Russin's psychic visions. And I should note here that we've called Ms. Russin and we've asked if she disputes the term psychic visions, if she wants to say anything else about this situation. The first time we spoke, she said that she had signed an NDA and was unable to speak to us. And every subsequent time we've reached out to her, she's declined. So again, I can characterize this as best we understand right. it and as is reflected in the investigative file. She might have a different view of what she does. We don't know. So the other thing that we learned in this latest round of investigative files that we got is that Ms. Russin was, in her time with OUR, being paid a monthly consultant fee of about $5,000 and then an additional sort of hourly and operational readings contract of $1,560, and that this intelligence was used to plan these missions. Subsequently, she was named as the executive director of Children Need Families, this adoption grant organization within OUR, started by Mr. Ballard's wife, Catherine. And at yet another point, when she served on the board of directors for another organization, she identified herself as OUR's, quote, director of strategic alliances, a job title we have never seen reflected, for instance, in their tax documents. So OUR recently told us that she had worked as an executive director for Children Need Families for 2 years, that she had left OUR shortly after Mr. Ballard did, and sort of refused to answer any further questions about her, what they called her self-proclaimed psychic abilities. They said that for that, we would need to ask Mr. Ballard or Ms. Russin.
Anna Merlin and Tim Marchman, we have a link to the reporting for Vice News on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. When does this story really start to unravel for Tim Ballard? It seems in mid-July, you both reported that as Sound of Freedom, this film is playing throughout the country to really big audiences, Ballard all of a sudden parts ways with Operation Underground Railroad. Is this sort of the beginning of the unraveling in some way for Tim Ballard?
Yeah. Interestingly, when we were first told by a source that Mr. Ballard had left OUR, we didn't believe it because it made no sense, right? This was presumably the moment of sort of greatest triumph for Mr. Ballard and the organization. The film had been finished in 2018, had been shelved for quite a long time, had finally been released, was getting wide distribution. Lots of people were talking about it. So, you know, to know that he had, you know, quietly left actually before the film even came out was astonishing to us. And I think that was really the beginning of a lot of things coming into the open. So we reported on that in July. We didn't feel comfortable reporting until September that he had left following a sexual misconduct investigation. But yeah, I would say that July, you know, this moment that should have been a really, really triumphant time for them actually turned into sort of the beginning of the end of their public image, Mr. Ballard's public image, that
is. Right. So what can we say now about the allegations of sexual impropriety, abuse? And I mean, it seems like this is part of your sort of ongoing reporting now. Maybe we should begin with what Tim Ballard himself has described as this couple's ruse, because it seems like this kind of tactic at least helps in some part explain some of the sort of sexual dynamics at play in this story.
So what Tim Ballard asserts is that as part of his undercover operations abroad, he would bring women, some women who worked for OUR, some who didn't, along with him, playing his wife. And the idea was that while they are engaged in business with traffickers, if a victim of trafficking is presented to Ballard in a situation where he might be asked to touch, say, a minor child, he could say, no, my wife is here, or she could intervene and say, oh, no, we're not having fun until later. So there are a number of problems with this. We've talked to criminal investigators, law enforcement officers who have done exactly this kind of work abroad, and they say it's ludicrous. It doesn't make any sense. For one reason, the idea that you're playing a sex tourist or a pedophile who's trying to meet up with traffickers and that you're bringing your wife, it doesn't have a lot of credibility that makes sense as an investigative tactic. And the other is that, as we've reported, these undercover operations have, for the most part, not involved going into deep cover and meeting up with a cartel point of contact or anything like that. Mainly they involve going to random bars and strip clubs and asking people for sex slaves, essentially saying that you want young children when they say, you know, I don't have young children, asking if they can get some.
It does seem like in your reporting of this that the drama that Tim Ballard talks about for these jump operations, or whatever, however he describes them, is really paramilitary kind of operations, seemed to amount to just what you said, them just sort of walking into strip clubs in seedy parts of cities.
Yeah, you can't really operate abroad with a paramilitary group. They don't have licenses to carry guns to foreign countries. They would be arrested if they tried to do that. So what they want to present is this image of the paramilitary jump team, you know, leaping out of an airplane into the jungle and, you know, then going about their mission. But the reality from many sources we've talked to is somewhat different. But all that said, that is the couple's ruse. The couple's ruse is the idea that an undercover operator needs to have a woman with him, working with him to carry out the undercover operation. So the central allegations that we've reported are that a group of at least seven women is known by Operation Underground Railroad's HR department following an investigation to have alleged that Tim Ballard wanted women to sleep in the same bed with him or shower with him under the guise of fooling traffickers. That basically the idea was that they had to test their sexual chemistry with him by doing these things or do certain things while abroad because it was possible that they could be being surveilled by traffickers. And we further reported that one of the issues here, which women who have come forward through an attorney have referred to as spiritual manipulation, was that Tim Ballard represented his own personal connection to the divine or his standing in relationship to the authority of the LDS Church as reasons to do this.
Spiritual manipulation, that was one of the sort of three charges that were made by these women. Grooming, sexual misconduct. They haven't. You haven't spoken with them yet. Their attorney spoke in a press conference last week talking about it. They will, as they've said, sort of come forward when they're ready, I suppose. What can you say at this point about that?
Our understanding essentially is that these women are not ready to talk to us. We know other people who have said they've spoken to them. One of them, interestingly enough, is a sort of right-wing libertarian media personality named Eric Moutsos, who was a very big booster of OUR and of Tim Ballard personally, and then said that in the last couple weeks he has spoken to, I think he said he's spoken to four of the women who I assume he was able to speak to because they're part of the same social circles is sort of my read of the situation, and that he believes them, and he's been, you know, sort of calling on Mr. Ballard to take accountability. So yeah, this statement that these women issued through their attorney essentially said that they felt like they needed to stand together and, as they said, affirm the truth behind these allegations, but have chosen for now to remain anonymous.
We were talking earlier about the fact that the church gave you, what is fair to say, an extraordinary statement denouncing Tim Ballard for this, you know, morally unacceptable activity and, you know, misusing President Russell Ballard's name for his, you know, cause and financial advantage. I wonder, what do you make of the reaction that you're getting to that? Reporting on the statement itself, it seemed like people, Ballard himself, doubted the veracity of the statement at some point. People were wondering on either side of, you know, those who supported Ballard, those who were suspicious of him. It's interesting how it's playing out in the sort of, you know, pro-Mormon, former Mormon sort of, you know, podcast atmosphere, the way people are sort of parsing that. What do you make of the reaction to it generally?
It's been a very strange bit of business because from our perspective, we got the statement from the church simply as a response to a request for comment that we filed to them, which we gave them because in the materials we were reviewing, there were a number of statements that would potentially implicate President Ballard in sketchy or unsavory activities. And so as a matter of course, we wanted to get his response for that. And so we went to the people who are authorized to act as intermediaries, say the church. So while the statement was extraordinary and we were quite surprised by it, it was also a pretty routine transaction. So we understood that it was unusual. The statement was unusual and it was unusual that it was given to us, but there was nothing all that out of the ordinary about it. And yet for weeks afterwards, it persisted, definitely encouraged by Tim Ballard, a sort of strain of truthering of the statement and questions about whether it actually came from the church or did it come from a rogue spokesperson? Did it actually represent the church institutionally? That has, I think, mostly been put to bed. And I think there's probably been a mix of some understandable naivete from people who aren't investigative reporters about how things work and like why the statement would be issued that, you know, I think has been addressed.
You wouldn't mind a few more details, but yeah, they at least gave you that statement, right?
Yeah, they've explained that there's nothing out of the ordinary here. So all of that did surprise us. But on the other hand, it wasn't all that surprising given that for the last decade, Tim Ballard has been presenting himself very successfully as the bulwark between good and evil, as someone who is thwarting the worst wrongdoers in the world personally with the help of his supporters. So while the specific mechanism of getting really into the weeds on whether a statement from the church was in fact a statement from the church, well that's a little bit off. The idea that people would find this startling and surprising and would have to take time to process and come to terms with the implications of it, I don't think is surprising in the least. We've seen that many, many, many times where somebody is representing themselves to their audience one way and the truth about them comes out and it's a shock to people. It should be a shock to people. I would hope people aren't wandering around so cynical, assuming that every person they hear of who is doing good is secretly, you know, up to activity that will lead to them being accused of doing not good.
What can you say about Tim Ballard's standing in the LDS Church right now, if anything?
So we're aware that there are very widespread rumors that he's been the subject of a church disciplinary process. We're not comfortable saying much about it just because the way that disciplinary process works, it would essentially be up to Tim Ballard to say anything definitive about it. The other party that could say something about it that would be truly authoritative would be the church, whether at the institutional level or the level of local leaders, without any of those parties having offered anything definitive. I don't think it's fair to say much past that.
Well, I won't ask you to spill the beans about what you're reporting on right now, but what's next for this story for you? What are the things that you're looking at?
Well, obviously, we're continuing to hope that the women at the center of the sexual misconduct piece of this story come forward and feel comfortable talking to us. The other pieces that we're looking at are a bit sort of broader ranging, I guess I would say. We keep saying to ourselves that surely we must be done reporting this story, and surely there is nothing else we could possibly find out. And then we get another phone call, we get another tip, we get another batch of documents, and we, you know, I've said that it's like peeling an onion, only the layers are just seemingly endless. So I hope in the long range that we get to the bottom of the last layer at some point, you know, in the next few years.
Yeah, and I think aside from our reporting, the developments in the story that we're tracking are just the obvious ones. Before the last few weeks, it was very clear that Tim Ballard was going to run for Senate. Yeah. He's had a lot of bad press, but we've seen in Republican politics in the last few years that bad press can bind you closer to your constituency and your supporters. I don't think it's a given that he doesn't run for Senate. And I don't think it's a given that he would do badly if he did run. So that's a big one. And the other thing that we're just continuing to keep an eye out for, and I'm sure many other people are as well, is the status of any possible prosecutions here. Yeah. Now, the investigation that we've reported on was closed earlier this year, but as the materials have made clear, there are definitely questions here that other agencies with jurisdiction would potentially be interested in. OUR is a big operation, has been a big operation for a long time. I think the total fundraising they've done since they filed for nonprofit status is on the order of $250 million. So when you're talking about serious questions about misuse of donor funds and some of the other things that have come up in these files, it's reasonable to wonder if other agencies might take an interest, if the changing political situation around Tim Ballard might lead some agencies that have previously taken a pass to want to take another look. And, you know, you can say that without any prejudice to Tim Ballard or OUR. If they are, you know, the subject of a new inquiry, if charges are brought, they will retain their presumption of innocence, you know, and they will have every right to deny charges and to defend themselves against them. But I think that if you look at the totality of the reporting we've done, and especially that based on the work criminal investigators have done, there are still open questions here. And I don't think it's a given at all that part of the story is over.
Tim Marchman, he's a journalist who writes for Vice. Anna Merlin is a journalist and writer. Her latest book is Republic of Lies. We have a link to the reporting on Tim Ballard on our webpage. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email comments or questions or suggestions to radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Tim Slover and Benjamin Bombard. Our intern is Elle Cowley. Our executive producer is Carrie Watson. I'm Doug Fabrizio.